Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to Jeremy Tigan, who is the author of Why Veterans Run Military Service in American Presidential Elections, 1789 to 2016. The book is published by Temple University Press, and I have the pleasure to talk to Jeremy on the phone today. Jeremy, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's great to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the book and for coming on today to talk about it. Before we get to your interesting book and your interesting research, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a professor of political science at Ramapo College in New Jersey, where I've been teaching since 2005. My research agenda tends to circulate around elections, electoral behavior, as well as the intersection of previous military service and American elections.
Wonderful. This the really interesting book that we're going to be talking about has a long historical span. And I want to add to the sort of introduction to the book that you have a book endorsement from Karl Rove, who is speaks very pleasantly about your book. So we can talk about how Karl Rove got his hands on the book later. But let's talk about the actual work. You start the book with this really interesting story about Strom Thurmond.
Right.
To get us started, I wonder if you'd share that story, why you began the book with it, and you know what the story actually says.
So Strom Thurmond was a World War II veteran, like so many men his age were. But he was a little older than the typical GI. He had a desk job in England during the ramp up for D-Day. And he wanted to get in on the action. And so he convinced some part of the 82nd Airborne to let him ride shotgun on one of the more dangerous ways of getting into Normandy, which was the disposable combat airborne ferry, gliders, which were, you know, just a stubby airplane without a motor that you'd throw a few men, a jeep, some weapons and ammo, and pull it behind a real airplane, point it at France, and hope for the best. He and his unit crashed in an apple orchard, were instantly under fire, and after a while, they were he got sorted out with another individual who reports that Strom Thurmond jumped into the foxhole and said, "Being in here on this here D-Day is going to be worth 250,000 votes back home." And that stuck with me as sort of the conventional wisdom that being a military veteran is somehow an asset on election day, that American voters prefer veterans in some way, shape, or form on election day.
And whether or not it actually resulted in that, Strom Thurmond wasn't wrong. He went on to a notable and successful political career after returning from the war. In some ways, what Strom Thurmond says is what most people sort of would assume, that military service is a positive. Your book is really about examining whether that's true, how true that is, and so forth. You focus on the presidency, and I wonder if we can talk just in aggregate terms. Whether Strom Thurmond was right at the presidential level. How often have parties nominated candidates with a military background? We can talk about exactly what that means in a moment. And how does that compare to what we would expect of the overall size of the veteran population at given points in time? So give us some of this overall look at what the numbers say.
Sure. That's a great question and sort of the motivating force that impelled the book, which is confronting a puzzle, which is, you know, the United States is a nation founded on fairly anti-militarist principles that had pronounced fears of a standing army. Yet of the 76 or so major party nominees since Washington, more than half of them have had military service. So trying to find the reasons behind the reason that our electoral system somehow favors the nomination of military veterans was one of the motivating forces behind this. And the first place I looked was to try to challenge that that conventional wisdom that Strom Thurmond screamed from a foxhole, which is, you know, is it an asset on election day? Because if American voters actually preferred veterans on election day, that would go very far in explaining and probably wouldn't warrant a book. But I ran quantitative models on more than a decade of congressional elections and more than a half century of presidential elections, and tried to discover whether or not there was a veteran advantage that you can find when testing, controlling for the things we know shape election outcomes. And the truth is, I couldn't find a systematic advantage that veterans enjoy that exists in all contexts. Like, there's no, you know, overall, you know, 2 to 5 percentage point, just to sort of speak arbitrarily, what the conventional wisdom might expect, advantage that veterans enjoy. In fact, there are a few elections when the veterans of one party did worse than the non-veterans of that party that were similarly situated. And so, you know, some kind of veteran boost on election day is not the reason why there have been so many veterans running for president, as well as you mentioned Congress. The same thing is true on the congressional side. There have been a lot of veterans in Congress and running for Congress as well, far more than you'd expect if, you know, we somehow randomly chose, you know, people into political office.
Now, Strom Thurmond had a very specific job in the military, and it was not a high-ranking general. It seems one of the goals of your book, and is also consistent with what you just said about sort of the overall findings, one of the goals of the book is to break down military service into a taxonomy of sorts. I wonder if you can describe the way that you did that and what it permits you to do that others haven't done in connecting one's veteran service to electoral outcomes.
That is another really good question, because it focuses on what I was forced to do when I sort of looked at this puzzle inductively, which is to try to look for patterns and say, you know, what if more than half of these individuals were military veterans, what does that mean? And that got me into thinking of, well, we've had different patterns of veteran emergence over time, and so I needed to differentiate the Eisenhowers from the Kennedys, you know, to pick two people that were both presidential candidates in the same you know 10-year cycle, and that there's a really big contrast in the kind of military service across eras. So if we take a look at the individuals that served in World War II, for example, they tended to be veterans that served very briefly in low officer ranks and got out of the service immediately at war's end in order to come home and grab the lower rungs of the political ladder. Whereas the individuals that served in the military and went on to run for the presidency in the antebellum period tended to be careerists in the military, high-ranking generals that were trying to make a lateral entry into presidential politics without having, you know, climbed the typical presidential path that goes through, say, a House race and then a Senate race or a gubernatorial run before the presidential aspiration. So I needed to break this service into a few different kinds of categories to include a common veteran, somebody who served in you know, peacetime or wartime without any combat exposure. The combat veterans were a unique category. The careerist general is a category, as well as I needed to make a sort of a small category for the Civil War general, because they were generals in a very different way than we think of, you know, a contemporary general, because they made it from civilian to colonel to general within a couple years, just because of the needs of the Civil War and the fact that it was a pre-professionalized service at the time. And then, of course, I have the non-veteran category to encompass the minority of individuals that ran for president who did not have military service.
And how do you deal with some of the tall tales that are told about military service? The exaggerations in some cases, sometimes get picked up during campaigns about someone claiming to have done X and they actually only did Y. How does that enter into the debate, which is the sort of the qualitative dimension of it, how people actually talk about their service? It's one thing to have it on a resume. It's another thing to make it a feature of one's campaign. Is there a difference between veterans that ran as veterans and veterans that have run, as other things, and just have that as a part of their personal biography?
There have been military veterans, some with quite valorous military experience, that actually downplayed it or tried to make it a biographical, checkbox that they wanted to get past. I'm thinking of George McGovern as sort of the biggest mismatch between the service record and the amount that it was discussed. He flew one of the most dangerous roles. He was a bomber pilot during World War II that, flew many daytime missions over Europe and went through many harrowing scrapes. But when he came back and started his political career, he, partially his campaign folks, wanted to, because of his positions on Vietnam, wanted to downplay his military experience. So there were, for people like George McGovern, it wasn't central to their political identity, but he's kind of the exception. For most people with military service, when they're running their first campaigns, they made their military service quite central. And this is fairly typical for the post-World War II generation, including the folks who served in Vietnam, is that they tend to, in their biographical information, on their websites, on their flyers, on their campaign leaflets, etc., being a military veteran is usually name-checked pretty high in their electoral efforts.
Now, this is a sort of a nuance of the book that's I mentioned in a couple of places, but how much of this is push and how much of this is pull? When we have candidate recruitment, do we see parties seeking out those veterans, or are veterans more likely to just express interest in running for office?
There's got to be both push and pull. That's a really good question, because it really gets to the center of where this appeal comes from. Because if we have this overrepresentation of veterans, and I only mean that in a quantitative way, and election day doesn't provide an advantage for veterans, then something between the candidate selection mechanism and the nomination has to be where this veteran appeal comes from. And I think that you're right that not only are veterans more likely to have the kind of civic engagement, streak in their personality, but I think parties go out of their way to help candidates and favor them in their candidate selection mechanism. And this is as old as the antebellum period, Andrew Jackson, and it's as new as the midterms this cycle. There's a stunning number of military veterans that are running for Congress this fall, and it's hard to put a number on it right now because the primaries are not over yet, and so I don't want to use numbers until we can actually do some apples to apples. But the new cycles this time around feel that there's going to be a high number of veterans running, and not just running in long shot races, but running in some competitive ones, with a lot of Democrats making a lot of hay with their military service records.
And is that does that suggest that there is an era that most resembles the one that we are in now? You break the book and some of the chapters into major eras and compare. And this makes sense because military conflicts do not happen either randomly or uniformly across the time period that you study, 1789 to 2016. So given what you just suggest about where we're at now, is there an era that this resembles where there were large numbers of military veterans running, or is this unprecedented in some ways?
It's unique in a couple respects. So if I were to, if this book were to be written, in 30 years, and this were, another set of presidential elections that I clumped into a case study, it certainly wouldn't look like the World War II or the Vietnam era, because all the individuals that have served in the armed forces since 1973 chose to do so willingly, whereas the World War II and Vietnam cohorts had both volunteers, but with, you know, high numbers of conscripts as well. So this cohort of individuals that have been trickling into Congress before, I don't want to make it sound like 2018 is the first time we've seen Iraq and Afghanistan veterans running for Congress, but it's 2018 seems to be a qualitative shift upward, something substantially different than what's happened. As far as another past year that it might resemble, you know, the name Teddy Roosevelt comes to mind, but he was an exception in his era. He was of the profiles of the military veterans in the book, TR was probably the most fun to read and write about, because no one worked harder to get into combat than Teddy Roosevelt. He was a man that, he was running for the New York legislature, and began his political career, and he lived with a stain that his father had paid a substitute in the Civil War, and it was the sole thing that he felt badly that his father had ever done. He worshipped his father, but that stain was something that may have motivated him to try to get into the fight any way he could. And he just lived in an era where we didn't have a lot of them. And so when the one war that happened, the Spanish-American War, he went through extraordinary means to try to get into the fight. And it took a great deal of sort of bureaucratic wrangling and political manipulation, as well as his own sort of deft maneuvering to get his unit into the right boat that would get to the war in time for the brief war in Cuba. And so him as a volunteer, I think you might find some parallels there, but by and large, I think this cohort of veterans from the Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, they're going to make their own chapter. I think they're going to be they're going to form their own patterns that are apart from past eras.
Yeah, well, one of the things that differs greatly across the time period of the book is the presence of women, and women in large numbers, in the military. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about gender, and whether how it fits into the story that you tell about the past, but also more importantly about the future. Could it be that the larger number of women serving in the military and serving in a wider array of positions going to be advantageous for women candidates with veterans backgrounds in the future? Is that something that we can anticipate? So maybe you can talk a little bit about how that fits in.
Women in politics is an evolving story, of course, and scholarship on, you know, women's entry into politics, especially in the last 25 years, has focused a lot on women's identity and how it intersects with voters and elections. Women with military experience, and we're speaking very speculatively, we just haven't had high numbers of them, and so we as a scholarly community have done a bad job of ignoring. We've ignored them. You know, I've been publishing on military veterans in the electorate for 15, 20 years, and I just simply ignore them. You know, there's the numbers just aren't enough to get analytic leverage, and that's just not good enough anymore, given that we have a larger numbers of women serving in the armed forces, making larger numbers of female veterans. And to imagine the Tulsi Gabbards and the Tammy Duckworths that are in Congress today with military service means that we can't ignore this question anymore. After 2018, we'll know how many more are entering Congress, and it's unquestionably the case that even if a minority of them win their races this fall, that among females, veterans would be really overrepresented in Congress, because there just aren't that many female veterans elected. But we've got some notables both in Congress and running for Congress. I think that it's an asset for women, military service, that is, because, you know, voters rely on a set of heuristics to make very quick decisions about candidates. Whether the first and most primary, of course, is knowing what party they're running with. But small biographical traits can do a lot to communicate, you know, information. And so military veteran is a tag that is, that easily communicates a whole lot of things to voters. I did an experiment a few years ago where I varied the campaign advertisement of a congressional ad, and I varied the military service record so that some respondents saw the saw the candidate as a military veteran, where other people just saw the candidate without the military service heuristic. And the people that saw the congressional candidate with military service vastly perceived that he was better able to handle national security and defense issues than the folks that saw his doppelganger that lacked military service. And so I think that, you know, women will gain an advantage for some fence sitting voters who are, you know, not necessarily set in their partisan ways, but will see more dimensions to a female candidate, because it opens the door to considering that, you know, a female has national security and defense chops when they might not otherwise.
Yeah, the book, again, is Why Veterans Run Military Service in American Presidential Elections, 1789 to 2016. Jeremy's book is published by Temple University Press. Jeremy, thank you very much for your time today.
It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.